Rob, drugs, sex, conservatism, and BYU. Rob starts school at BYU with skepticism, which leads him to fall away. He spends 6 years at BYU enjoying drugs and sex while maintaining his endorsement. As an abnormal ex-Mormon, Rob finds himself abandoning his progressive views after leaving the church and becomes more conservative. This is his story.
Marco.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, what's up, Jay? How's it going?
Good. Connection sounds good.
Okay, so, cool.
Yeah. Also, one thing I got to let you know, this isn't edited in any way. It's just raw. And so just you know, be a little bit more cautious if you don't want to, I don't know, just think about your words, I guess. And then also,
I mean, if I accidentally slip out like where the bodies are buried, is there a way to edit it, or am I just going to go to jail?
It depends if a cop listens and cares to investigate, you know. Hopefully by the end of this podcast, they like you enough, they don't give a shit.
Okay, yeah. Well, to the 10 people listening, don't rat me out.
But yeah, thanks for tuning in. Also, if there's a interruption, like somebody calls or whatever, then I might have to resend you the link.
But. Okay, cool. I will put my phone on do not disturb. Okay, cool.
Perfect. So, you know, this episode, as I promised the people on the page, it's about drugs and sex at BYU. And so it's very interesting because a lot of people, you know, when they think of a BYU student, they think of a BYU student as like being a saint, right? They can do no wrong. At least that's how I used to perceive anybody at a CES school. And it's just going to be interesting to hear about that culture and, you know, what it can be like as a BYU student. And to see how a person going to BYU can actually get into, you know, into drugs and into like sex and still continue to get their endorsement, which has been the craziest part about hearing some of your story.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
But first, let's tell us about yourself.
Sure. I mean, I'm guessing you just want to know kind of like the cliff notes of like my early Mormon journey. Is that what you mean by?
Yeah. That and about yourself, kind of like, you know, your background a little bit, like your family's background, and how you ended up even going to BYU. So yeah,
sure. Okay. I mean, I grew up Mormon in a Mormon family. Both my parents are still very active, although none of my siblings are, interesting enough. And I had a very sheltered childhood. I was homeschooled as well. So Mormon and homeschooled, you know, very sheltered, very naive to the world. And I actually joined a community college when I was 15. And then a year later, I joined their debate team. And that was really where I became like political, right? That's where I developed my interest in politics. And it's also where I really got exposed to different kinds of worldviews. I mean, particularly the progressive one. I mean, basically, everyone on the debate circuit in the Northwest is like hyper progressive. I mean, they were woke before woke was even like a mainstream concept. So did that, got my associates, and then applied to a few different colleges.
This was when you were 15. You went to start college when you were 15.
Yeah. Well, I started a community college when I was 15. Yeah.
Damn.
Just like, you know, they have like these high school programs and I joined a little bit early.
Yeah.
I got my associates, applied to BYU, got in, and I basically went inactive within a few months. I mean, like at that point, I had never really vibed particularly well with the church. Not that I had big issues with it per se. I mean, there were some, you know, questions that kind of clashed with my political beliefs at the time. But largely, it was just like I didn't really have very many spiritual experiences. I didn't really feel the spirit very much. You know, I call myself a spiritual retard, right? It was just kind of like whatever gene or personality type or whatever that or spirit that gives people access to those kinds of like mystical experiences in church. I just never really got them. So it was a pretty natural progression out of the church in a lot of ways. I mean, it came with some conflict for sure, but
wait. Before we get into that though, so would you say before you started this community college, this political stuff, were you really active in the church? I mean,
yeah, for sure. Members.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was active basically while I was, you know, at home. I remained active. I mean, I broke the word of wisdom a little bit when I was like 17, 18. But for the most part, yeah, active, obedient. You know, I was in leadership positions. I went to all the extracurricular activities, Eagle Scout, you know, all that stuff.
So what about like, as far as your family, did your family do family prayer?
For sure.
Read scriptures, yeah. Family home meetings, all that.
Oh yeah, all that. For sure. We would, you know, read scriptures together. You know, we all read the Book of Mormon together when Hinckley did that challenge. I mean, yeah, my parents, and again, my parents are still, you know, very active. So yeah, very, very kind of typical active Mormon childhood in a lot of ways.
Dang. So, did you, like, when you were at college, did you begin to see that, like, you know, a lot of times people are, I feel like one of the big reasons the church has, you know, parent families do that, those types of challenges, you know, study together and family home evening, stuff like that, to kind of nurture you at home. Did you feel like once you were, you know, enrolled in those classes, those professors, you know, were they influencing you more? Did that begin to, like, getting into that political team, did that begin to shift your views on Mormonism, or how did that begin?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my questions did kind of start from that progressive view. In terms of my professors, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that, because while I was at BYU, like my second year, or no, my first year, actually, they introduced like this new class, a new religion class called Foundations of the Restoration. Mm. And so I was one of the first people to take this class. And essentially it is like, it's about the early history of the church. And it is, you know, it addresses a lot of these kind of political controversies, right? Whether it's around race or gender or polygamy. That is essentially the purpose of the class, is just like to investigate those things in a safe environment with a professor that's knowledgeable about the context and discuss. And, you know, I always remember feeling somewhat unsatisfied when, you know, he would ask us to turn to the person next to us and just discuss like some controversy, how that made us feel, and you know, how we think we would have approached that if we were living at that time. And I felt like a lot of the times the answers I was getting from the classmates were simply like, well, listen, like it just comes down to faith. Like you just have to believe that you know, God knows what's best and prophets know what's best. And yeah, that never really satisfied me per se. And that's really what kind of got me thinking, okay, if I don't have enough faith to, like, if I had lived during that time and I don't think I have enough faith to stay then why should my faith be sufficient now? Right. And so that really, I guess, got me thinking. At the end of the day, I mean, at the time I really wanted to have some sort of like rational reason, some sort of like empirical reason as to leave the church. And it came down to the fact that just, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of motivated reasoning for people to both stay in the church and people to leave. And I just wanted to make a decision that I felt cool with and felt right about. And so after that, I kind of got closure on the fact that I just didn't have enough faith to stay in.
So that was like your first few months at BYU.
Yeah, so that would have been my first full semester. I mean, I started like spring and summer.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit active during those two months or two semesters or quarters. But yeah, my first semester, you know, I took that class and I already wasn't very active. And that kind of like sealed the deal. I think it was either that semester or the next that I actually took some discussions with like some sister missionaries. I was kind of dating this girl that was encouraging me to reevaluate my decision. And I just thought, you know, why not? And so, you know, I discussed it a little bit with the sisters and we had some great conversations. You know, I you know, remember those sessions fondly, but it didn't really change anything.
But you said, like you said, you weren't really that active already. I mean, what, and I guess my first question was that already beginning to be influenced by those professors at that community college?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. yeah, absolutely. Particularly my debate coach, right? It was really my debate coach that, I mean, this guy was, like I said, I mean, these guys were hyper woke before woke was even a thing, right? I mean, this guy hated America, hated Disney, but he would go to like porn festivals, right? So, like, naive, like, homeschooled Mormon kid, like, he was, you know, pretty out there, but, you know, I had a lot of respect for him. He was an effective mentor. And yeah, he just got me thinking about a lot of different things. Now, at the time, I was still defending the church. Like when my debate teammates would ask me about Mormonism, I was happy to defend our beliefs. But at the same time, you know, I was also bringing up a lot of these questions I was having with my bishop, with, you know, my my priesthood leaders, you know, arguing with them about, you know, gay marriage and this kind of stuff.
Hmm. Okay. So that's interesting. So that did have an impact. And then was there like before the whole foundation, you know, the taking that class at BYU, was there already this shift of, well, you know what, I kind of don't really agree with some of this already, or how did that go?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I just remember thinking about the various policy shifts that had happened within the church that seemed to be in a reaction to the world's morals, right? Like we're kind of taught as Mormons that the church is supposed to be like this kind of independent entity that, you know, holds true to the gospel regardless of what the world's morality shifts to. But you would have these cases where, like, you know, like other colleges are not playing basketball against BYU because of the Blacks in the Priesthood controversy or the whole polygamy thing, right? And it just seemed like the cause and effect was largely the world's morality kind of driving the progression of the church. And that just kind of destroys your idea of like the legitimacy of this kind of independent entity that's just getting direct revelation. You know, I think a lot of people kind of have issues with this, right? I think it was Doc that kind of mentioned a similar issue he had with like Hawaii and the Family of Proclamation or something.
Yeah. And yeah, it is interesting though how that does how as a believer you're looking at it and you're thinking, oh yeah, perfect timing, revelation from the prophet. As an outsider, you're like, of course they'd cave.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think the proclamation of the family, I mean, I didn't totally understand where he was coming with on that angle, because I think it makes sense that like they would add revelation to affirm something that the world is starting to attack. But when the church is ceding to the world's morality, it gets a little dicier there.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so going back to this, so this person, the sister, you're taking discussions from the missionaries. This girl's trying to get you to, you know, reconvert. And then was that when you finally just decided to step away from it, or?
I mean, I was already inactive. I had already basically decided to step away. It was just simply that, you know, I was getting some pressure from her, and I just thought, you know, it doesn't hurt to, you know, give it a chance. You know, because to some degree, you do kind of hope that it is true. Like it is, you know, if the church was true, right, it would be the most interesting, exciting thing in the world, right? Like that's something that occupy, you know, you for eternity, right? But I just had a few discussions with the missionaries, and it didn't really go anywhere. And they were super respectful, right? They weren't like trying to like push me. Well, I mean, obviously they're trying to teach me, but it was largely just a discussion. And we had some good conversations.
So that, and then the same girl, was that the one that you asked that went on a mission and then after trying to get you to become Mormon, and then she came back and now she's like anti-Mormon, right?
Yeah. So she was actually preparing to go back on our mission when we met. So she had some health issues and then came back to BYU and then was preparing to go back. And so she was still very much in that mindset. And then, yeah, years and years later, she texts me, and yeah, she's totally out at this point.
Damn, how the tables turned, or how the turntables.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of ironic because we had so many arguments, dude. Like we would argue for hours and hours and hours about theology and politics and all this stuff. And so, yeah, it was kind of amusing to see where she's at now.
Huh. And what, so did she come home for like mental health issues or just health issues?
No, just she got sick. She got like the flu really bad or something.
Oh, and then she finished her mission.
She didn't actually go back. She was preparing to go back, but that actually never happened.
Oh, really? Huh. A woman changed her mind, huh?
Never thought that. Unheard of.
Yeah. I apologize to everybody who thinks that's a misogynistic comment. But so from there on out, at this time, like when you're inactive, I guess tell us about like what came first once you're at BYU. Was it the drugs or was it the sex?
It was the drugs. I mean, so I had smoked weed and drank back in my hometown before I went to BYU. But yeah, one day I was actually doing summer sales, and one of my friends was like, "Hey, we're gonna go do mushrooms in the park this weekend. You want to come?" And I knew nothing about drugs at all, or you know, mushrooms or anything. And I was like, "Yeah, cool, sounds fun." I actually had malaria at the time, so I was really sick.
So how were you knocking in Africa or what?
Well, I had come back from Africa. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I took a break in the summer. But so yeah, took the mushrooms, and it was just super fun. And that, I mean, I went back to Provo and told all my friends, like, "Guys, we got to try this shit."
Yeah, spreading the good word.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so Rob, you go back.
I go back.
Yeah, so you go back.
So at the time, so, you know, people that were in Provo, you know, might remember this, but there was an app called Yik Yak that was really popular in Provo. It was actually kind of one of like the main hubs for this app. And it was like this anonymous posting, like kind of Twitter feed type of thing. And it was eventually shut down because there was just a bunch of harassment. It was like a very horrible place for people's mental health. I was never really on it, but there was like this huge community of yakkers that, you know, would post and rant about Mormon stuff. And eventually they started meeting up and throwing parties. And so that was kind of my introduction to like the Provo party scene.
And this was your sophomore year at BYU?
Yeah. Like end of sophomore, starting junior year.
Oh, okay.
Ish.
And so, go in there. So mushrooms was the first drug you ever tried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, other than just like marijuana.
And then eventually marijuana.
No, I had done marijuana before.
Oh, okay. And did you get like cooked on that, kind of like doing it, or just was it one time sort of thing?
I've never been much of a stoner. You know, I'll smoke socially, but yeah, it's never really been my thing.
Okay, so then shrooms obviously is probably amazing.
Yeah, shrooms is great. I mean, like I told you before, like I had always kind of considered myself spiritually retarded. And so having this, I mean, on mushrooms, you get like this kind of mystical experience. You get like all these, I don't know, it's a very emotional experience. Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing else like it. And so, yeah, I think, you know, experiencing that, it was a real eye opener, and it definitely like piqued my interest in just like consciousness in general, and you know what the possibilities were for different kinds of experiences, and that kind of led me on a road where, I mean, I've tried all kinds of different things, a lot of different kinds of psychedelics, but a lot of other drugs as well. Probably overdid it. I mean, definitely overdid it, to be honest.
Like at school, or just in life in general.
Yeah, just in life in general. I mean, most of this activity was done while I was attending BYU, though.
Dang. So, I mean, how was it meeting those yakkers, those BYU students? Like, did that kind of surprise you that there was all these BYU students that are willing to do drugs?
No, not particularly. I mean, it's kind of amusing, right? And like, obviously, a lot of these yakkers aren't BYU students, right? Like, you know, U of U students and just, you know, kids that are just around Provo, but not really. I mean, like from my hometown, I mean, there was plenty of students or kids in my ward that did drugs and all sorts of things. And so it wasn't like a shock to find that some people were breaking the commandments.
That's interesting. That see, that honestly shocks me, because a couple years ago, you know, I kind of wanted to experience the college party life and decided to start hanging out with some kids that like to party. And I remember a few kids from BYU showed up, and I was so intrigued that these people were they were willing to do drugs, they were willing to have sex, and then they would just go to school the next day, and or like the next semester, and like that always just that impacted me, because I was like, what the hell? Like, do these people? I mean, and granted, at the time, I wasn't being my best self either, but like I wasn't going to BYU, you know, and so I'm thinking like, do these people not have a conscience? You know, like what the how so how did you get away with going back to school? Because don't you have to have like a bishop interview and talk about that?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, you have to have your ecclesiastical endorsement. So I mean, the main issue I really had was simply that I wasn't attending church, because that's on the record, right? Like that's something that any bishop is going to bring up if you haven't showed up to church for like a year. At least I assume so, right? But I didn't give them a chance to ask that question, because every time that I was due for an endorsement, I would just switch wards. So I would move and go to a different ward and then get my endorsement right away. And if it's just some kid coming through, like they're not going to ask a lot of hard questions. I really didn't have to lie that much. And you know, I was, if the, you know, bishop asked me how my testimony was doing, I wasn't like, oh yeah, I'm just like a full believer in Jesus. You know, I would say I have doubts, and you know, I'm not really feeling it right now. And blah, 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 blah. And sometimes I would even tell them, you know, I don't barely hardly ever go to church. And yeah, for the most part, everyone was just fine with it. I mean, they would of course invite me to start attending. But yeah, I never really met a bishop with the balls to just be like, all right, well, if you're not attending church, then just like get out.
So that's surprising. I always thought, especially after my mission, you know, I thought like, dude, there's no way I could go to BYU. You got to be like, you got to be a saint, you know, you can't be doing this and that. And I was a saint for a while after my mission, but it never got to, I mean, there was after like a year after being home, I began screwing up, and I just thought I'd never be able to go to church school ever again. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's kind of like this ethical question of, you know, whether, you know, a guy like me that isn't, you know, following the commandments should, you know, should even go to BYU, right? And, you know, I would get asked that every once in a while by people that knew what was going on, because I was always very open with, you know, basically anyone in my social group, right, about, you know, my lifestyle. And look, I think it's a legitimate question. I mean, at BYU, they are trying to create a specific experience, kind of an oasis for people that are believers that are going to be long-term contributors to the church and find, you know, a spouse that has those same values. And, you know, they're trying to create a unique experience that you can't really get at a normal college. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And so, yeah, like to a certain extent, was I, you know, diluting that experience? And, you know, certainly kind of lying, right? Because I was breaking the honor code. You know, the ethical question about that, you know, I think there's a legitimate reason to think that, you know, maybe, you know, I wasn't doing a good thing there. But that being said, I was already at BYU. I was, you know, following the commandments when I showed up, and it just didn't make sense for me to leave. And so I just never had the motivation to like really care that much.
Yeah. You're like, well, they're not stopping me.
And yeah.
Cause I guess to a certain degree, yeah, you were being honest. You were like, nah, I don't go to church. And they were like, yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the one time I definitely did lie to a bishop was when I had longer hair, and the bishop brought it up and was like, hey, like, what's with the hair? And I told him that I was a Lamanite actor in the Book of Mormon series, and that they wanted me to have longer hair to, you know, be more historically accurate or whatever. Yeah, he just let it fly.
Damn, that's actually one hell of a lie. That's a funny lie, though. and so this is interesting then. I mean, so you studied there for what, 5 years, 4 years?
Dude, I was at BYU for like 6 years.
Damn.
Yeah, still didn't graduate, by the way.
Wait, but tell people this. You didn't graduate, but you only have like what, 5 credits left?
Yeah, I only have 1 semester left. I was enrolled in one of the shortest like majors at BYU. I was there for like 6 years, and keep in mind, I already had my associates before I even showed up, and I didn't fucking graduate.
That's insane. That why didn't you graduate?
I got a job that I really liked that I was doing full time, and I showed up to BYU with very like romantic ideas about college and kind of the education system. Neither of my parents went to college, and so it was kind of like, I don't know, I think they kind of impressed on me like this very like romantic ideal of all the learning I was gonna get when I was at college. And I was pretty unimpressed for the most part. I didn't really respect my professors intellectually. I didn't find them like very curious people, and I just got sick of it. And once I got my dream job, I just decided to drop out.
That's 6 years. So were you doing other majors too? Like, I mean, how the hell?
It took me a long time to declare. I switched majors several times, and like, you know, during those 6 years, it's not like I was going full time. I mean, I was taking semesters off to travel, to work, do internships. You know, it wasn't like 6 consecutive years, or it wasn't like full time 6 years.
Okay, but you got the dream job that you wanted to get by finishing college, anyways, right?
Well, I didn't finish, but yeah, I got my
right. Okay, so what about the this is the part probably people want to listen to more is the sex part, dude. Tell us about that. How many years after being inactive did you? Because you went into BYU. Did you go into BYU being a virgin?
Yeah,
really? I was.
Yeah, I lost my virginity. I was probably like 20.
Dang, like sophomore there or junior or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, the vast majority of my sexual activity was not with BYU students, right? It's like, you know, friends, people you work with. It wasn't like, for the most part, with people that were attending BYU. I mean, it's not to say that other BYU students aren't having sex. Like, I'm sure there's plenty of that.
Yeah, there definitely is. I speak from it. Well, anyways, go on.
There definitely is, but you know, there's an extra layer of complication there. I tried to be pretty respectful of people's beliefs, and I didn't put a lot of effort in trying to like seduce BYU girls.
So by the time you actually did it, was it like, did you still carry a lot of that Mormon guilt associated with it?
No, I didn't. I never felt guilty about any of that stuff. I mean, I was inactive for a long time before I lost my virginity. And that's part of the reason why you got to be careful, right? Is like, you know, other people do experience guilt differently than I did. And I mean, I learned this by just like making out with a girl, right? And then she would feel super guilty about it the next day and blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, that extra layer of complication just kind of always turned me off to the idea of like, you know, trying to even date a Mormon girl or, you know, go out with BYU girls in general.
That's interesting. But I mean, there were some BYU girls.
For sure.
Yeah. And then in your experience with those other BYU girls, did they also, did they have Mormon guilt, or were they kind of already out?
Sure.
And then just,
oh yeah. Oh no. The guilt all over the place. Like I said, like, I mean, even making out with them, right, would sometimes cause all these issues. And so I don't really recommend it.
What are your thoughts on that?
On what?
Just like on the fact that these people, I mean, just even the, because I mean, I've been there too, like just even having the sensation, right, of being aroused, it makes you feel guilty. Like, what are your thoughts on people dealing with that? Or I guess, how would you like help them navigate through that? Because I'm assuming there comes this point in your life where you've been like, had these experiences happen to you, you know, your freshman year, you probably would have been in the same boat, right?
I don't know, man. I mean, like I said, I'm spiritually retarded. So the whole guilt thing, I mean, that's one of the main things that kind of drive you away from the church, right? Is you'll sin. For some people, they'll sin. And like that Brian guy said, you wake up the next day, you feel fine, right? You don't feel like a different person. You don't feel the, you know, Spirit of Christ leaving you. And so that kind of just degrades the legitimacy of the teachings that you've been given your whole life. So, yeah, I mean, the emotional aspect of it was never a huge issue for me. I mean, in terms of what I would say to other people that are dealing with that guilt, I mean, I don't know. I mean, look, society has all sorts of really dysfunctional ideas about sex, and I certainly don't have, you know, all this stuff figured out. But it's not like once you leave the church, like everyone is super enlightened about sex and everyone, you know, they just do it perfectly and they never feel bad about it and all this stuff. Like, there's all sorts of social issues that are entirely secular around sex, right? I mean, it's just one of those taboos that kind of seem to be a part of every society, right? And like right now it's Me Too. Before that it was, you know, this idea that, you know, girls have sex the same way that men do, and that causes its own issues, right? And so this is, I mean, it's a complicated subject. I don't have a lot of strong opinions about it, but, you know, dysfunctional ideas about sex don't seem to be very unique to any religion or sect.
Interesting. So let's see here. This is probably going to be one of the shortest podcasts, just because of this. I mean, this is kind of intriguing. So going on, you know, experimenting drugs and doing all these things, did you ever feel like you became an addict in any way?
No. And that is kind of the main thing that people bring up from like a secular perspective is, oh, aren't you worried about addiction? And I guess I don't have an addictive personality. Now, that isn't to say that, you know, experimenting with all these drugs isn't cost-free, right? But the addiction aspect of it was never really a problem for me personally. Obviously, for a lot of people, they do have that issue. And so, yeah, I mean, if you guys are anyone out there listening that's thinking about experimenting with this stuff, like, of course, do it responsibly and keep an eye out for that kind of stuff. And there always is a cost, right? There's always trade-offs. There's no free lunch. And like personally, I've kind of lost interest in, you know, drugs in general and experimenting with that kind of stuff as I've gotten older. That being said, I don't necessarily say that people shouldn't do it, right? Like, you know, it's you know, having fun is, you know, important, even though that might seem trivial. And I mean, it's certainly, I think, you know, particularly psychedelics, they can kind of open your mind up to, I don't know, like viewing the world in a fresh way, I guess. Like, I don't know, particularly for people that are like emotionally kind of closed off. I think that, you know, this feeling of enchantment that you get with the world and just how incredible people are and nature is and all these things, like that is certainly something that I think is valuable to a certain extent. And, you know, the experience itself is fleeting, but you can kind of carry some of that over into your life. And obviously there's decreasing returns to this, right? Like after your 100th, you know, dose, you're not getting the same benefit.
Yeah, psychedelics are interesting. It seems like there's almost a, you know, I don't know. It seems like to me, psychedelics, they almost have like a purpose. Like there's only so much you can do before eventually they kind of just tell you, move on, bro. Like, why are you still doing this? I don't know. That's just kind of a thought I've always had about it.
For sure. No, I think that's a healthy way of looking at it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that view psychedelics as teachers, right? They, you know, particularly ayahuasca, right? Like they'll refer to Mother Ayahuasca and they'll act like there's some wisdom somehow inside of psilocybin or, you know, what, you know, DMT or whatever, that it has something to teach you. And, you know, I think, I wouldn't phrase it that way. I think the way, you know, it's kind of silly in some ways. I don't really like hippies or get along with them very well. But but certainly, like, yeah, again, that feeling of enchantment, that feeling of, like, appreciation for just how the world is and that feeling of gratitude for, you know, people in your life, like, that is something that at certain points in your life can kind of, yeah, motivate you to be more appreciative of the little things. Now, that being said, if you do this too much, and I think this happens with weed as well, like you can become somewhat, you can kind of lose your ambition to a certain extent, right? Like if you're just so involved with kind of like this hippie, non-materialistic view of the world, and you just think, you know, I can just be at peace with nothing except for, you know, me and myself in my room. I don't really need anything or anyone. Like eventually that does become pathological. And I mean, there are changes to your brain that are happening over time. And I think that, you know, you do want to be someone that keeps their drive, keeps their ambition, wants to actually change the world and do things in it, not just be at peace with it, right? And I think that's kind of like the darker side of psychedelics that, you know, isn't maybe discussed as much, but it's pretty obvious once you, like, you know a lot of people that have done it too much. And look, there's some people that obviously, like, do it all the time and they retain their ambition, they retain their drive, but that's the exception. So yeah, certainly something to keep in mind if you decide to start experimenting with the stuff.
Yeah, and what, I mean, what kind of drugs did you experiment while you were at BYU? You said you started with weed, you did mushrooms, and what other kind of things were you out there doing?
Yeah, so I've done acid, I did Molly. I kind of got involved in the rave scene while at BYU, and so I did Molly and ecstasy.
What's the difference there? I didn't know there was a difference.
Well, so they're both MDMA. It's just the ecstasy is pressed in a pill and is, you know, sometimes cut with other stuff. But yeah, MDMA.
What's Molly?
It's MDMA. It's just not cut with, it's just like the pure crystal as opposed to it cut with, like, or pressed in a pill.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And tell us what that feels like. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, so ecstasy is a good, you know, word for that drug, right? Because essentially what you're doing is you're overdosing on amphetamines and your brain is just juicing and producing all this and just flooding the system with serotonin and, you know, some dopamine as well. But it's really the serotonin that just gives you this feeling of ecstasy, of, you know, of, like, love and care and kind of oneness with the people around you. Like, if you're on ecstasy and, like, a stranger walks in the room, you just have, like, this feeling of unconditional love towards them, right? So, yeah, it's a great party drug. It's a great drug for, you know, just, like, a large group setting of, like, a rave, right, where everyone's just, like, vibing to the music all at once and, you know, you're all rolling and you just kind of feel connected to this whole organism that is experiencing the music. Really fun, you know, definitely toxic to your brain. You can't do it a lot. Like, you can't even do it like 2 days in a row because there's only so much serotonin in your system.
Drained after? Do you feel like the next day?
Oh, for sure. Really? Yeah. Done? With all these things, yeah, you typically feel somewhat drained afterwards. Yeah, that's the trade-off is sometimes even for a few days, if your just serotonin system is depleted, like, you're just not as energetic and you can even feel like somewhat apathetic. But people have very different reactions to these things. Some people don't really have much of a come down afterwards, but, you know, most people do. And there's some supplements you can take with MDMA specifically to kind of help restart your serotonin systems. So yeah, with all of these things, like, if you're going to experiment, you should try to do some of the extra work to reduce some of the negative effects of these things. And I was, to be honest, like, usually pretty poor about all this stuff. Like, I was not a very responsible user. And, you know, people talk about set and setting. I would usually just ignore that completely and just, you know, experiment with different drugs at different sets and different settings and not really care about any of that stuff. And yeah, like, I certainly have regrets of my kind of more irresponsible use. And that's the thing is, like, I think a lot of people, when they leave the church, right, they've been told their whole life, okay, all these drugs are just terrible for you. And then they try something like marijuana and they're like, okay, that really wasn't that bad. Right. And so kind of all the breaks that were put in their system for experimenting with this kind of stuff are just removed because the people that were telling them these were terrible are, you know, they're not considered like a legitimate source of information anymore. And so I think, you know, some kids, and me in particular, if you're particularly naive, you can be somewhat reckless with this stuff. And you just want to try everything because, you know, the brakes are off. You just feel free. You just want to try all this stuff. You want to explore consciousness. And yeah, I mean, it's quite easy to take that too far. Like, there's a reason why society has these norms. And it's kind of taboos, right? That's not to say that, you know, you shouldn't do it, right? I'm not going to tell you not to, but, you know, try to do it responsibly and try to understand, like, what the risk is, right? Like, at the end of the day, you are impacting your brain. You are killing brain cells. Typically, anytime you're flooding the system with some sort of chemical, like, that system is going to be affected in some way. It might downregulate. You might lose some receptors, right? And you know, that's not really considered with a lot of, you know, the kids at these parties, right? We're just a bunch of ex-Mormons, and we're just trying this shit out. There's not a ton of scientific literature on it necessarily. But even the stuff that is out there, like, you know, we're not necessarily reading all these academic articles on the, you know, neurochemistry of the shit. And yeah, it's just kind of a free for all. And don't get me wrong, it's fun to do it that way, right? And there's a time and a place for it. But, you know, there's also, I think the healthy way is there's kind of a natural progression out of it and a general like maturity over time where other things in your life kind of take priority. And you, ideally you just kind of naturally lose interest in it, right? Like I've had mescaline with me for like over a year now. I've just been carrying it around. And what I think it's mescaline. Yeah, it's another psychedelic. It's derived from like a cactus.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, supposedly it's like really interesting and like a really fun experience. But again, I've just kind of lost it or two. And so I'm just carrying the shit around with me. And I don't know if I'm ever going to use it because it's just not really like a priority anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, going back to what you said about, you know, you try these things and then all of a sudden the source telling you that it was wrong loses credibility when you realize it's not that bad. It seems like the healthy way to go about it is tell people like, bro, this stuff's pretty cool, but like you got to be responsible with how you use it rather than being like, no, it's just out bad, you know?
For sure. Yeah. And the thing is like, that sounds so obvious. And you know, most people that are doing this stuff, you know, will tell you the same thing, but when it comes down to it, you know, when you're 21 years old and someone's just like, hey, like I found some Molly, or hey, we're making DMT, like come try it. Like there's not a lot of thought that you put into it. It's just like, at least I was like, hell yeah, let's just try it. And there wasn't much of, you know, further pondering about, okay, like, do I actually want this right now? Like, should I really be doing this in the middle of a semester? And look, that's natural, right? Like you're a young guy, you're going to be reckless, and nothing in life comes without risk. Like get comfortable with risk. I think that's a healthy thing to do, and get comfortable with some trade-offs, right? Like the reality is like even working out, like if you go to the gym your entire life, you're going to be jacked. You're also going to cause a lot of inflammation. That inflammation over time can affect your brain. Like it's not necessarily good for you to be working out all the time, but for some people it's worth it, right? They want to look jacked. They want to look good. They feel good in the gym. They feel good mentally, right? And that's fine, right? Like most things are not entirely good or entirely bad. And you know, you just gotta be conscious about what the actual consequences are.
You know, it's interesting though that you say that about you had no hesitation, but then this is from my own experience, right? As you know, before I became LDS, I tried marijuana when I was in high school and became LDS. And then, you know, it was a very long time. It was several years, even after my mission, where because I had already tried it in my youth, I knew it wasn't like that bad. And then I think one time I was in therapy and they gave me some Ritalin. They said, hey, take this Ritalin. It'll help you numb your conscience. Cause at that time I was dealing with OCD. Right. So I took it and then I found myself ended up, somebody offered me marijuana like a couple days into my treatment. And I, without hesitation, I did that. And then I actually got a medical card for it. But then when other people would offer me anything else, I always just thought like, dude, no way. You know, and I did have a lot of I was hesitant towards it. So it's just interesting to, you know, but once I ended up, you know, eventually at some point in my life trying some, you know, somebody said, hey, if you try this, it'll help with your depression. And I did it.
Then the windows open, you know, that's when everything else opened. Right. So do you think it has more to do with, like, do you think you would have tried MDMA or these other things without having tried the mushrooms first?
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to tell. Right. But yeah, I mean, there are gateway drugs, obviously, right? Like people say, you know, marijuana is a gateway drug or it's not, and they argue about that. But it just is. Like once you know drug dealers, right, you know, one of those days that you buy something from, he's going to be like, oh, hey, I have this. Do you want to try this? And you're like, sure, right? Once you're with the people that do drugs and you're partying, like other stuff is going to be introduced and you're more likely to try it. Like that's just how it is, right? And so it's hard to say whether, you know, if I hadn't done mushrooms at one time that I probably would have at some point, you know, just based off my friend group at BYU, tried something else. Yeah.
Yeah, I took a very long approach asking that. And then one other thing I wanted to ask you though was, did you have friends at BYU that did drugs too?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh,
for
yeah. Sure. And how did you see their lives go? I mean, did you see them just like begin to degenerate and like get into all kinds of things as well? Like, guess what are some of the more wilder experiences that you've seen from your time at BYU?
Well, I mean, most of them are doing just fine, right? They're, you know, they've grabbed careers, they're thriving, as far as I know, right? Yeah, look, did I see some people really spiral? For sure. How much of that, did the drugs play a role in that? You know, probably to a certain extent, I'm sure, right? I think weed is honestly one of the more dangerous ones because you can do it every day, right? And you know, some of these other stuff, like you're not going to do Molly every day. That's just absurd. But some people can justify smoking every day. And I think it's in some ways just that daily usage is a lot more dangerous than some of these more extreme drugs that in any one instance, maybe they're worse for you, but just the fact that you only use them once or twice a year, that makes it like overall better. But you know, it's never just drugs on its own, right? Like I think typically people that really spark, like if you're using, like there's so many people like in America that do cocaine, right? Or heroin or whatever. And like probably a decent portion of them have perfectly functional lives, right?
Yeah.
But if you are depressed already and you're doing drugs and you have like, you're just neurotic in general and you have like crazy political beliefs that make you hate the world and you aren't doing well in school and you don't have a good familial support system and you have shitty friends that only really like you because when you're hanging out with them, they're high, right? Like, then yeah, you can really spiral for sure.
Yeah, you, Ian, you mentioned something that just got me thinking about that. I was gonna say it's interesting that, you know, growing up just by the educational system, you're taught that only losers or people of low status do drugs, and that, you know, you realize, yeah, that's false. I mean, even just in my own community, I know people that run very, very successful businesses and they love to do weed. They love to do cocaine. They love alcohol, you know? And so it's just been very interesting to grow up as an adult and see some people do drugs and they're low level, like low status in society, but there's a lot of high functioning people that love to do drugs. So
yeah, there's a guy, I think his name is Carl Hart. He's like a Harvard professor. He's been on the Joe Rogan podcast. And I mean, he does all kinds of shit. I mean, he does everything. He does like heroin, coke, all this stuff. And he's kind of, his career, or at least the podcast he was on with JRE, was kind of focused on trying to like reduce the stigma. And my pushback against this, because like a lot of times, you know, you'll hear, you know, people, you know, when you're partying and they'll kind of mention like, it's crazy, this is illegal and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, they want to push back against the stigma. But the thing is, so there's this concept called luxury beliefs, right? And it's essentially like a belief that can serve you if you're high status and well off, but as actually a disservice if you're like lower class, right? And I think the drug issue is one of these where, sure, if you have everything in your life going well, then some drug use isn't going to impact you that much, right? But if you are, you know, impoverished and you're struggling and you don't have a good social support network, then there's a lot more possibilities for that to harm you. And so this idea of trying to reduce stigma, I actually think might have more negative externalities than the people that are just taking it and they're doing fine and they're going to college and everything's fine for them realize, because there's a lot of different contexts in which actually this can be a lot more harmful for you.
Yeah, thanks, and I actually appreciate you for bringing that up. So I guess the moral there is, if you're struggling, don't do drugs. Wait till you're doing good in life before you do them, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the larger lesson here is just like, be careful about determining like what your policies are, what your political beliefs are based off of just your own personal experience, right? Because there's a lot of other people out there that have a very different experience than you. And just basing these ideas off of your own personal experience, it's just silly, right?
Right. Well, and it can also be in reverse when it comes to judging people too. I feel like, you know, not thinking, well, they did it once and so they're piece of crap, you know? It's like, no, well, they just tried it out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to judging people, it's like, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, maybe in your community, I don't know, I'm not necessarily part of like this whole LDS confession sphere, but you'll hear a lot of people say, oh, we shouldn't judge, right? That's not Christ-like. And I think that's stupid, right? Like to be alive is to judge, to operate in the world is to judge. You always will be judging, whether it's consciously or unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And what you want is to judge correctly. What you want is to fine tune your judgment so that it has predictive power, so that it, you know, is correct, that it's good judgment, right? And to do it consciously and not just leave it, you know, as a passive unconscious thing. And so, yeah, I guess that's one of the things that I guess annoy me with people that it's the same people that like are against stigma in general, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we shouldn't stigmatize things. And it's like, okay, well, what are the externalities of removing the stigma? Because, you know, we live in a modern world where your optionality is just completely endless, right? And like that guy that the doc dude that's like now experimenting with polyamory, right? Like, it's really exciting for him to get explore this new way of relationships and sexuality and all this stuff. And that's totally fine. But he even admitted in that podcast that, yeah, to be honest, like I think that, you know, monogamy is what's best for society. Right. So even though he acknowledges that for him in particular, it's not the best thing for him, the removing that stigma, like what would the consequences of that be at scale? Right. Mm. And it's that scale thing that most people often, they just kind of ignore and they just think, oh, well, in my own particular instance, I felt I was judged and that seems unjust to me. But you have to look at the wider picture. And that's what I think conservatives in general are better at, is thinking about the kind of the second and third order effects of, you know, things like stigma and how is this actually going to impact the wider society. So, yeah.
So would you say then, it's interesting, you know, you said you started off progressive and now you're sharing more conservative views. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think what often happens as people develop their political views is once they kind of depart from their childhood beliefs, right? We all kind of grow up with a kind of a simplistic worldview that is given to us, that kind of is at the level of complexity that, you know, a child can understand. And then as we grow up, oftentimes there's like a developmental stage where you reject that and you kind of go towards the opposite, more transgressive views in order to add some nuance and some complexity to, you know, what you're given as a child. People just stop there, right? Or sometimes they just stop at the first worldview. Some people stop at the second. And I think both of those are like really bad. Right. Ideally, you move on from that transgressive phase and you try to integrate the two views together in a way where you kind of resolve some conflicts and then can continue your journey in a way that appreciates both like the kind of the simple idealistic view maybe you're given as a child with the added complexity that you developed over time and kind of refine your taste for, you know, what is good, refine your judgment. Mm.
And so for you, that's been transitioning from, I guess, LDS, progressive, and then conservative.
Yeah, the progressive phase was my transgressive phase, right? I mean, this was you know, the stuff I adopted from my debate teacher, right? That, you know, opened up my horizons, but was in itself kind of insufficient to really navigate the world. And so, now I would call myself more of a conservative. You know, I spent some time labeling myself as a libertarian, but these days I really lean more towards the conservative side of things.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. So, that being said, at this point, I mean, I did want to ask you this because I know you've told me about this in person, right? So you've when it comes to seeing people spiral out of control, I mean, you brought up a story once of a couple that decided to try weed and then they ended up becoming swingers or something.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a married couple
at BYU, right?
Yeah, they had both gone to BYU. One of them was attending at the time. And the story is that they were driving through Colorado at one point, and I guess they kind of agreed that weed wasn't against the word of wisdom, right? So they were still approaching it from a Mormon moral framework. They just thought that the word of wisdom was kind of like didn't apply to weed in particular. And yeah, within a year, I mean, these two were married in the temple, you know, Mormon families. And yeah, within a year, they were totally out of the church and were swingers. And it was a very fast transition, for sure.
Hey, why do you think that happens? Like, what do you think? It's just such a like you know you open up, you experiment with one thing. It's like you open up Pandora's box. Like, what do you think is the psychology behind that?
Yeah, I mean, people say the slippery slope is a fallacy, and to the extent that you know, maybe in some cases the slippery slope is like more persuasive, and it's kind of a simplistic way of looking at things, but. Overall, yeah, it's a real thing, right? And I think particularly with Mormons in particular, it's like once you decide, okay, I don't think the prophets are right about this one thing, it's the cracks in the system are going to, you know, expand, right? Like if you think of a house, right? And you think about there's certain areas in the house in which certain, you know, joints have a little bit more pressure and they're a little bit more fragile. And once there's a crack in there, some water gets in there, and then because you know that joint isn't supporting as much of the weight as it was before, now other parts of the house are under stress, right? And so this can happen with people's ideology, right? Like the Mormon religion is a set of patterns, a set of beliefs that kind of work well together when it's all one cohesive whole and when it's integrated into a larger community. Right. This is why BYU works really well, is because, you know, everyone there is kind of on the same page. Right. It's all this mutually supporting integrated system. But if you introduce some cracks in there, it can expand super quickly. Right. And this is why, you know, these movements at BYU to like make it more inclusive or whatever, like I think are kind of silly at the end of the day. Like, I think that BYU was able to offer like a very unique experience to some students. And it's like this own internal world that once it's gone, it's just going to be gone forever, right? And those students that want a more inclusive atmosphere, they can go to almost any other college in the U.S. to find that, right? And so to some degree, I don't know, I think for some ex-Mormons that are a little bit more resentful and want to like bring down the church or make it more like progressive in some ways, even though I'm not Mormon myself, I guess I appreciate the self-sustaining system that it is. And I think it actually is like a relatively functional subculture. And so I kind of push back against some of the people that want to like modernize the church or make it more progressive. Right. Like I know you spoke to Heather, I listened to that podcast and you know, this is someone, yeah, that wants that is staying in the church to change it. Right. But I think what these people don't realize is, you're kind of introducing a weakness that can spread and make the entire institution kind of crash. And because the reality is like the modern world has already tamed and kind of domesticated religion in general, right? And so further degradation, I actually don't think is going to make the subculture more functional. I think it would make it less functional.
That's interesting. You know, even me at myself right now, I'm in a faith journey, right? And that is one thing I do, I guess. I would agree with you on that. I appreciate, even if I don't agree with their ideals, I appreciate that there are institutions and organizations that stand behind an ideal, you know, that don't cave or bend, regardless, even if I don't even believe in their ideology or against it. Like, I appreciate the fact that they exist. Just because
for sure.
It's nice to know, like, well, you know, it's good to know like your enemy, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I think the fragility of these systems is not well appreciated, right? Like you think about an ecosystem, and an ecosystem has all these, like, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of different organisms that all kind of work together in a way that's self-sustaining. But then you introduce one organism and that can totally fuck the entire thing up, right? And that's how I view institutions. That's how I view, like, you know, religions and ideologies in general. And so if you have some issues with the church and you think, well, I just want to make this small tweak here to make it better, I guess I would just caution, like, what, like, you know, is that small tweak really just going to be isolated in that one dimension that you want changed, or is it going to spread, right? And is it going to cause further dysfunction? Because, you know, we've talked about this before, like, there's kind of this trade-off between cohesion and inclusion. The more inclusive you are, the less cohesive a group is going to be. The more exclusive you are, the more cohesive it's going to be. And in order to grow, you have to be inclusive, right? But if you are too inclusive, then it stops meaning anything. I mean, any major city that you go to, you're going to see churches that have BLM flags and pride flags, you know, just like on the building. And when I look at that, it's just, I don't know, it's interesting because you just wonder, like, okay, who, what kind of church is this actually, right? Is this actually a Christian church, or is it actually a progressive church with Christian dressings, right? Because I think over time, what's already happening is there's certain secular beliefs that are kind of taking over and fulfilling a lot of the needs, the psychological needs that people get from religion. So for instance, if you were to talk to like a progressive BYU student and you were to ask them, like, what are you doing to prepare for like the second coming, right? Like, like most people don't really have like a ready answer for that, right? Like, oh, I'm, you know, following the commandments and praying, but it's not something that keeps them up at night, right? They're not like fearing judgment day. But if you were to ask them, okay, like what they think about climate change, right? And they're an activist, like, this is actually what I talk about. So how is the world actually going to end in their mind? Climate change is taking up more psychological space for them. So even though they are Mormon, like, what are they, there's kind of this bleeding into the secular American civic religion, I've noticed, is really bleeding into, you know, the church in a bunch of different ways, right? And a lot of ways it's just more powerful, right? Because the kind of educational and media forces are all indoctrinating us in these kind of secular eschatology or secular taboos. And over time, I think that gradually takes over more of the mind share for a lot of Mormons. And even though, again, they're still Mormon, at the end of the day, they're still like, they're more progressive than they are Mormon. And if they had to choose between the two of them, you're going to see more and more people just choose their secular religion as opposed to their revelational religion.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you see a lot of people are leaving the church and then, you know, they become full on liberal. You know, I think even, I mean, when I was talking with Doc, that's one thing he mentioned. He's like, he's definitely a lot more liberal now.
Right.
That was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we're religious animals, right? Like, like whether your religion actually has a theology or not, like you're going to have a religion, and those psychological needs need to be met by something. And so, whether you leave a religion or not, you're still going to be religious.
You're interesting because you are an ex-Mormon who still wants the Mormon church to stay alive. You know, you want it to stay. I mean, that's what I get from you anyways. You want it to exist still, even though you're not part of it. You're like, well, I still want it to exist.
Yeah, I mean, I would be sad if the Mormon church just like crash and burn tomorrow. Like I said, I think it's a relatively functional subculture that does more good than it does bad, and, you know, helps a lot of people.
Which is interesting because I've talked to a lot of ex-Mormons that think the opposite. They think it does more bad than good.
Oh my goodness, I know, dude. Like I've had like hours of debates with people that literally think that the church is a net negative on everyone it touches and just a total parasite. And it's just insane, right? I think these people are not very good at like modeling people that aren't exactly like them. And, you know, are probably a little bit resentful. Like when you leave the church, you go through a period of time where you feel like you've been lied and manipulated to your whole life. And that can really eat on you. And, you know, hopefully you outgrow that relatively quickly because it's not good.
Did that eat on you?
Yeah, there was a period of time where, again, like you just feel like you've been lied to your whole life. And, you know, that resentment is natural, right? But But yeah, ideally you mature out of that relatively quickly and realize that, I mean, because here's the thing is like so many people, you listen to like these Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins types. And I used to, you know, read all their books and listen to their podcasts, and there's some good content there. But their model of the world is basically like, okay, if we just get rid of religion and everyone becomes secular, then we're all just going to be more rational. And I think it's pretty clear that that's a pretty dumb idea, right? Like people outside of the Mormon church are not really more rational. There's all sorts of crazy ideas that are perfectly secular. They can take hold of them and hold them completely captive, right? Because again, like we're just religious animals, right? Like we're never going to evolve beyond that, I don't think. And so you just adopt some secular religion, and then now that is what is, you know, that's the hive mind that you become a part of. And look, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, right? Like hive minds make sense. They're efficient. Like we can't process all information empirically. And so we process it through trust networks. We process it through who do I consider legitimate? Who's a good source? Who do I trust? Who has good character? And then we value information coming out of those sources, whether on a personal or institutional level, much higher than sources that we find, you know, that we don't trust. And that's just how we act in the world. And again, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. But one of the advantages of, you know, these revelatory religions, these you know, classical religions, is just that they acknowledge that their belief is based on faith. Whereas it's talk to, you know, a quote unquote rationalist, and they think that their effective altruism or whatever is just purely empirical, and they're not influencing it by, you know, values or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So would you say that that's not true? When people say no, now, because this is one thing I hear a lot from ex-Mormons, is they say, "I am, now that I've left the church, I am more loving and more caring, and all this, you know, all this stuff towards people without having God being held over my head." I mean, what do you think about that?
I think, you know, I would certainly be skeptical if someone told me that. That's not to say that it's never happened before, right? But like, I think what people usually mean by that is I am now more inclusive, right? I now love humanity more. I have this universalist view of the world, right? And now I'm just more inclusive and my love is less exclusive, right? And, you know, one of my theories that is, you know, kind of like, you know, it's not necessarily like, I don't know, it's just like a simplification, but there is somewhat of like a fixed amount of love that you can offer the world. And when you have this universalist view, like it's like inflation, right? Like the actual value of the love decreases, right? Like if you're on Molly and you love a stranger who walks into the room, what is the value of that love, right? Like it's not very high, right? Because if someone else walks in the room who's also a stranger, you love them just as much. And so there's not a lot of value to that kind of relationship. People that say, oh yeah, people that have this view of, I am so much more enlightened now that I've left the church. Look, I'm not saying that in some ways, yeah, they've acquired more knowledge in some dimensions that is more fitting to their character and maybe has resolved some inner conflicts. There's, you know, that's entirely possible. But in general, I think, yeah, we often trick ourselves and have motivated reasoning to justify our decision. We can kind of lie to ourselves in some ways in that regard.
Yeah, that's interesting. So where do you find your beliefs now? I mean, because yours are interesting because they're contrary to the beliefs of, you know, everybody that I've interviewed that's left the church. Yours is like, yeah, I've left. I still vibe with the church. I mean, I still vibe with the idea of the church. So what are your beliefs officially stand now?
What are my official beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, obviously our beliefs are always changing, but like, what sure. Would you say your the ideas of like where you're heading as far as your ideology is?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. How do I answer this? I mean, the skepticism that I had while I was Mormon has never gone away, right? I've simply applied it to wherever I find myself in the current moment, right? So yeah, for a time I was super woke, super progressive. I eventually moved away from that, and I've had a few phases in between since then. And yeah, to be honest, I mean, it's yeah, I don't know if I have like a really concise label or explanation of what I believe now. But you know, I'm evolving, and it's I don't know. I still don't really know, to be honest. I don't necessarily think I'm enlightened. I don't really think I've figured out the right moral framework. I don't think I've really become like a much better person since leaving the church, or that leaving the church caused me to become a better person. I'm still, yeah, I'm still learning and trying to grow.
That's interesting. So, yeah, I kind of wanted to end with that. I did want to cover obviously the drugs and sex, but also, again, it's just always been interesting to me that you've shifted from, you know, being progressive and liberal to being conservative while leaving the church, which is very nuanced view.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the utilitarian view of the world is very seductive because it's very easy to understand and it seems very rational. And so that's why most people kind of move to that post-religion, right? And it fits very well within the progressive framework. But yeah, utilitarianism, like it's not really an ethical model when you dig into it. It doesn't actually really tell you much. You still have to inject your own values and virtues into it for it to work. So on its own, it doesn't really doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's interesting. Any last thoughts you want to leave us with, Rob?
No, not really, man. Yeah, hope this was helpful. Thank you for inviting me on. It was an honor.
No, well, thanks for coming on. And you know, as this podcast continues to grow, I think we'll find it, and maybe some will listen to the very end, and some might not. but there's I guess the whole point of this podcast is to show there's different ways of going about Mormonism, right? Whether you stay or leave, and even after you leave, it's interesting that of the way you've gone through it. So I appreciate that viewpoint, and I hope anybody who's interested in continuing to see different viewpoints, you know, as we get different characters, different people on this podcast, it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of just get a wider view of the world through the lens of a Mormon.
Yeah, totally, man. I dig this project. I think it's interesting. I'm glad you're doing it, and I'll definitely I look forward to seeing where it goes.
Yeah. Well, our next episode it's going to be great. You're going to be the next one published, and then we'll have another guest who is also interesting. So look out for that one.
I will, for sure.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Take care. Have a great night.
All right. Peace.
Bye.